Welcome to the second teleseminar in our series entitled Conversations on Building a Culture of Peace. How can you use Lead the Way? It's sponsored by the Peacemaking Core Team, a network of volunteers that has been working to implement the Congregational Study Action Issue on Peacemaking. And I'm Judy Morgan, as Max said. We are extremely happy to have Sharon Welch with us this evening to address the topic of strategic options for building a culture of peace. Sharon is the provost of Meadville Lombard Theological Seminary. She is the author of several books, including After Empire, The Art and Ethos of Enduring Peace, and has a new book that will be published soon entitled Real Peace, Real Security. Sharon has been an active and leading member of the Peacemaking Core Team. And now I'm going to turn the floor over to her. Welcome, Sharon.
Thanks, Judy. It's so exciting to be involved in this conversation with people, as I've noticed, all the way from Alaska to Alabama, and to invite you in to a conversation that the members of the core team have been involved in for some time now. I noticed John Hooper's on, and Larry Schaefer, and Judy and Mac, and a student of mine, Pam. Hi, I'm glad you're here. I'm so excited that we have the opportunity to spend some time exploring the implications of the resolution that are before us. The resolution is extremely timely, and I'm sure many of you know it quite well, but I'd like to begin my remarks by reading it for us once again. Should the Unitarian Universalist Association reject the use of any and all kinds of violence and war to resolve disputes between peoples and nations, and adopt a principle of seeking just peace through nonviolent means? For the next 10 minutes, I want to walk through some of the options that are now facing us and the choices that we have as UUs and as global citizens to really move closer to a world of enduring peace and sustainable security. I'd like to begin with one of the basic principles of conflict resolution and conflict transformation. Whenever we find ourselves in a situation in which there are two dichotomies, once we explore those dichotomies more carefully, more often than not, we'll find that there are more internal options within each polarity, each side of the dichotomy, and we'll also find that quite often there are very significant areas of convergence. And that is certainly the case with the choices that are phrased in the peacemaking resolution. And so I'm going to begin by exploring the idea of just war and what some of the creative and new options that are emerging in terms of just war thinking, and then turn to what we find on people who are committed to pacifism and nonviolence. And in both of these sides of the spectrum, from just war to people committed to nonviolence and pacifism, we are living through a very significant paradigm shift. And I think understanding that paradigm shift will help us as you use and address and answer this study action question more carefully. So first, just war. I'm sure many of you know just war theory and understand its basic contours. First of all, just war theory addresses the conditions for war, and then it addresses as well the conduct of war. And just war theory puts limits on each. Conditions need to be primarily defensive, and the conduct is one in which there is a limit on force of two kinds. First of all, non-combatants, civilians, are to be protected, and then the idea that the amount of force used should be proportional, that no more force used in defense than was used in the attack. Now, within just war theory, the basic assumption is that while killing is always wrong, and why war is always dangerous, war is sometimes necessary because military force is an ultimate form of power. And sometimes there are situations in which we are dealing with nations or groups of people where force will be the only thing that can be understood. Now, this assumption that force is the ultimate form of power has, of course, long been challenged by peace activists. We can think of the work of Gandhi or the work of Martin Luther King. But what is extremely significant at this particular time in our nation's history and in the development of world history, this assumption that force is the ultimate form of power is also being criticized from within the military. Now, let me back up for a minute. Peace activists have long criticized the idea that force is the ultimate form of power, and I'll rehearse just one of those critiques that I'm sure many of you have heard before. In an article in The Nation in August 2006, Jonathan Schell posed the question quite starkly, and I quote, "Given the results of the U.S. wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, can we claim any longer that the military power that defeats armies, that kills insurgents, which destroys buildings, monuments, and infrastructure, is a lasting power?" Schell, in his work, refers to the philosopher Hannah Arendt, and he talks about the limits of coercive power. And he claims, actually, that military force is a form of weakness, that rather than being the ultimate expression of power, that military force is a futile attempt to coerce where one cannot persuade. Now, lest we think this line of thinking is limited to those who are pacifist or who are committed to nonviolence, I want you to listen to the 9 representative paradoxes of counterinsurgency. These are paradoxes that are described in the recently released draft Army and Marine Corps Field Manual. This is released in 2006. 1, the more you protect your force, the less secure you are. 2, the more force is used, the less effective it is. 3, the more successful counterinsurgency is, the less force that can be used and the more risk that must be accepted. 4, sometimes doing nothing is the best reaction. 5, the best weapons for counterinsurgency do not shoot. 6, the host nation's doing something tolerably is better than our doing it well. 7, if a tactic works this week, it might not work next week. If it works in this province, it might not work in the next. 8, tactical success guarantees nothing. And 9, most of the important decisions are not made by generals. Well, I ask you to think with me. Do these paradoxes mean what we think they mean? Listen again to the description by Colonel Crane, who was the director of the Military Institute at the Army War College, and he was one of the writers of the New Doctrine, and he describes the genesis of that doctrine, and I quote, he says, "In many ways, this is a bottom-up change. The young soldiers who have been through Somalia, Haiti, Bosnia, Kosovo, and now Iraq and Afghanistan understand why we need to do this." And what is happening is that there are many voices within the military are saying that we need to fundamentally reexamine the actual impact of military force. This is evident in the further explanation that is given to each of these paradoxes. And I'll return, I'll speak here of only 3. One of them, the more force is used, the less effective it is. The explanation: using substantial force increases the risk of collateral damage and mistakes and increases the opportunity for insurgent propaganda. Second, the best weapons for counterinsurgency do not shoot. The explanation: often dollars and ballots have more impact than bombs and bullets. 3, tactical success guarantees nothing. The explanation: military actions by themselves cannot achieve success. So this manual reflects 2 things. It reflects a rigorous application of just war theory to the conduct of counterinsurgency warfare, taking into account the real cost of killing civilians and whether those deaths be intentional or the unavoidable byproducts of attacks on military forces. But there's a second aspect of this manual that is equally significant. And here there's the recognition that not only do civilian deaths matter morally and strategically, but there are real limits to force and a real need for peace-building activities to restore security and gain popular trust. In the foreword to the manual, John Nagel states that these nine maxims, and I quote, turn conventional military thinking on its head, because in this worldview, the primary goal is securing the civilian rather than destroying the enemy. And in order to secure the civilian, it is more important to provide electricity, jobs, a functioning judicial system. It is more important to address the legitimate grievances that have led to the insurgency in the first place than it is to simply use military force to contain and kill insurgents. So the field manual is very significant because it reflects a fundamental shift in understanding the power of violence. What we have emerging within large segments of the military is the recognition that in the face of dire threats, of real threats to national and human security, large-scale violence is not only devastating, and as the Dalai Lama put it, war is the fire and humans the kindling, but large-scale violence is ineffective. Military prowess alone cannot produce endurable security and lasting peace. Hence, the paradigm shift in those who are advocates of just war. Now, to quote the American Friends Service Committee, and this is a quote that I think many of you have probably heard quite often, if war is not the answer, what is the answer? How do we work together to build sustainable security and joint peace? And what I find very exciting at this particular moment, that in the work of pacifists and peace activists and those committed to nonviolence, there is a similar paradigm shift as in those who have been advocates of just war. The shift within the world of peace activism is twofold. First, many peace activists are seeing our work as being primarily constructive and proactive rather than reactive. And while it is essential that we criticize war, it's essential that we work for disarmament, it is equally essential that in order for these criticisms to take hold socially, in order for disarmament to become an actual possibility, that we need to provide tangible, institutionalized alternatives to war. So a move to the rule of law between nations and a move to the rule of law, which leads us to three different types of constructive peace activities: peacemaking, peacebuilding, and peacekeeping. Now, I'm going to explore each of these. And after I explore these forms of working for concrete, creative alternatives to war, I will then open it up for our discussion. So first, peacemaking, peacebuilding, peacekeeping. Peacemaking is the negotiation of peace accords between the different parties in a conflict. Peacebuilding is both preventive and restorative. It's the creation of long-term structures for redressing injustice and resolving conflicts nonviolently. Now let's spend some time with peacemaking. What does it take to reach a comprehensive peace accord? And what are the common elements of sustainable peace agreements? It is often extremely difficult, as I'm sure most of you know from your reading of world history, as well as our recognition of the conflicts that exist in our current situation. It's often difficult for parties to move from armed conflict to the negotiating conference. And in fact, many times people will turn to negotiations only after they've reached a hurting stalemate, a sense in which neither side believes that there's a chance of military victory. If we want to help a conflict move toward negotiations before we reach that hurting stalemate, before people are absolutely exhausted and resources depleted through the use of military violence, it requires the intervention of the international community, quite often under the auspices of the United Nations. And the term that is used for this intervention is called Friends of the United Nations. And these are countries who become involved and will pressure different parties in the conflict to turn to negotiations, and then once in negotiations, accept conditions that people in the international community see as viable. One example, the negotiations in El Salvador, in which the former revolutionaries became part of the government, was greatly enhanced by the group of nations who worked to encourage their allies among the different factions to really turn to a peace process and renounce military violence. So this couldn't have happened without the work of Venezuela and Mexico and Spain and Colombia, because they were all involved in pressuring, again, their allies to work for peace. So to get to the peace accord quite often requires international intervention. And then the nature of a peace accord is also requires quite often international help in crafting what becomes not merely a terms for settling a particular, reaching a truce, of ending a particular type of fighting, but an accord needs to create terms on which opposing parties are prepared to live in peace with each other. John Paul Lederach, who is an author and a specialist in conflict resolution, talks about successful peace accords become platforms. And so what's important is not just the particular terms of agreement, but that these are platforms for then resolving the further disagreements that will occur, that these are platforms for continued reconciliation, for restoration, and for building a social order in which future conflicts will be settled without violence. Now, what we have here is a recognition that peacemaking, reaching a peace agreement, while absolutely essential, is absolutely insufficient. Because once a peace accord has been reached, there are still major issues that have to be addressed. And these issues are looking at the causes that led to the hostility, as well as repairing the damage caused to a society by the months, years, and sometimes decade of armed violence. Here we now move to peace building. In the little book of strategic peace building, Lisa Shirk, who is a professor of peace building at the Eastern Mennonite University's Center for Justice and Peace Building, reflects on her experiences for 15 years. She's been involved in peace building in the U.S., in Latin America, Africa, Asia, the South Pacific, and Europe. And she describes the work that is before us, this constructive, proactive work, as strategic peace building, and identifies four elements to such peace building. The four elements are waging conflict nonviolently, reducing direct violence, transforming relationships, and building capacity to meet basic needs in human rights. Now, I'll spend a few minutes on each one. First, building capacity to meet basic human needs and protect human rights. Here is the recognition that peace activists need to spend as much time in redressing what the political grievances that led to war as we do, of course, in protesting war. And we know the kind of grievances that lead to violence: longstanding economic injustice, human rights violation, racism and discrimination, and that it is important that these be resolved for there to be a just peace rather than a peace that is merely a peace of the grave or a peace that is the imposition of an unjust status quo. And so it's very important to spend our time in challenging structural violence to build capacity to meet basic human needs for political life, political participation, and economic life with dignity and equity. Second aspect of strategic peace building is transforming relationships. And here I would like to highlight two key dimensions of this type of peace building. The first is the reintegration of combatants into society. Combatants need to be disarmed, demobilized, reintegrated. Jobs need to be found, alternative source of income rather than the income that came from being part of a militia and some of the quite often kind of looting and larceny that is part of warfare. But while jobs are necessary in a way of becoming involved in the political process, there's also a need for culture and religious reintegration, rituals of forgiveness and healing that can allow former antagonists to live and work together for a common good. And so reintegration has many different tasks. It's economic, it's cultural and religious, and it's also political, the integration of competing forces into a newly unified political system. Now, another aspect of transforming relations is the need for restorative justice. And we are beginning to see many examples of this in, of course, South Africa, in Liberia. And this, I mean, at the current state, the process of restorative justice is as much an art as it is a science. Because while there's a recognition that it is extremely important, we're just beginning to explore how to make it possible for society to heal the wounds of the trauma caused by war and create a new narrative of what it means to exist together as a people. For example, justice is not met merely by ending the war, and it's not even met even if there's a more equitable division of political power and economic wealth, because there is still the trauma of the lives that were lost, the torture, and the trauma of those who are both victimized as well as those who found themselves victimizers in the way the process of violence sears the soul, and it sears the soul of people on all sides of a conflict. The need then for restorative justice is one that is extremely important in building peace. Now, the third dimension, and this is one that many activists know better, and we've developed some pretty good skills, and this is the matter of waging conflict nonviolently. Societies will always have conflict. Conflict over resources, over the best ways to respond to basic human needs. And in an ideal situation, these conflicts are resolved through the political process, which is itself nonviolent. So there's a fair electoral system that political parties are able to operate without fear of the suppression of dissent. There's that journalists are able to do the kind of investigative reporting that calls people to accountability and accuracy, and also that there is a working judiciary and police forces which are themselves accountable to the citizenry and enforce the rule of law rather than the power of one particular side or another, one particular political faction. So waging conflict nonviolently includes working through the electoral system, through the judiciary, but it also includes nonviolent direct action when that process is ineffective. So sit-ins and strikes and boycotts and demonstrations. Okay, a fourth aspect of strategic peace building. Now here we come to a paradigm shift. As large as that among the proponents of just war. A fourth aspect of strategic peace building is reducing direct violence through the timely utilization of peacekeeping forces. Here, there's a very interesting convergence that within many segments of traditional peace churches, Quakers, for example, members of the American Friends Service Committee, many Mennonites, there's a recognition that at some times, now this is a shift, while violence alone cannot solve problems, armed intervention may be a necessary ingredient in a larger humanitarian response. Now the resolution that is before the UUA calls for rejection of any and all force. But this is no longer a view that is held by many peace churches. The reasons for this shift to conditional acceptance of the use of armed force can be symbolized quite clearly by the names two regions in the world, Darfur and Rwanda. We know the devastating cost of unchecked crimes against humanity in both situations. In Darfur, thousands of women and girls have been raped, 250,000 people killed, and 2.5 million displaced. Such grave crimes against humanity have happened before, as in the case of Rwanda, and are likely to happen again, because we know that in our contemporary situation, serious threats to security are not just posed by conflicts between states. They're caused by national disasters, international conflicts, governmental repression. Under the leadership of Kofi Annan, the international community began to address this complex set of issues and pose the question in just this way. When a government cannot or will not protect its students, when a government cannot or will not protect its citizens from rape, mass murder, and other crimes against humanity, does the international community have the responsibility to protect those peoples from ongoing catastrophe? The answer within many circles of the international community is increasingly a resounding yes. The answer is that force is often needed to protect populations at the onset of a conflict. Force may also be needed after a conflict is resolved, needed at this point to stop revenge killings and retaliatory ethnic cleansing by those who were previously the victims of attack. Now, one of the things that is important to realize, though, about the mandate of peacekeeping forces is that while the mandate of such forces is important, it's nonetheless limited because, unlike military forces, peacekeeping forces are not designed to defeat an enemy, but have rather the task of clearing the space where negotiations can either resume or begin. And I think it's helpful if we think of these interventions as being more like community policing, an international police force, than military campaigns. And they also require a careful coordination with civil society in order to restore the society's internal sense of order. There is a proposal now before the UN to establish a United Nations Emergency Peace Service, a standing force, 15,000 volunteers from all over the world, but it would include, in addition to armed peacekeepers, medical personnel, lawyers, judges, engineers, construction personnel, and people who are skilled in nonviolent conflict mediation. Three constructive tasks: peacemaking, peacebuilding, and peacekeeping, all comprise the constructive work of strategic peacebuilding. Now, the task is daunting, but in pursuing these constructive responses to genocide and violence, these constructive alternatives to war, we are not alone. There is a movement that crosses national borders, that crosses political allegiance, that unites those who know firsthand the horrors of war and those who have never seen war, yet have committed their lives to creating alternative means of addressing structural violence. This movement seeks nothing less than a Pax Humana, an international rule of law sustained by a commitment to justice, equity, and compassion. The question that faces us all is, are we daring enough and are we creative enough to find the political, cultural, and ethical resources to make a Pax Humana real? I invite you now to join me in a consideration of these options, and I invite your questions and your comments.
This is Judy. I just want to remind you to press star 6 before you speak. That will unmute your line.
Hello. This is Ariel.
Hello, Ariel.
Yes, I'm speaking from Toronto in Canada, and would like to thank you very much for that presentation. I've been involved in the peace movement in Canada for a long time, as well as with the work for the United Nations. The thing that has struck me is we are increasingly realizing that peace is the necessity for humanity, but we have not yet won over the vast majority of people. even though we are convinced of it, and I expect most of the people here are, we have to find the means to show that peace is the practical necessity of humanity. And you might have a couple of comments on that, because I think we've got to get our message across in a way that will reach the majority of people. And that's a serious problem for us.
Well, it is.
I've been involved for about 40 years in the peace movement, so I want to make it more effective.
Oh, thank you, Ariel. It's, well, you're in a country that is doing, I think, as much as any other country in the world right now to make things, the alternatives to war, more effective and more believable. I mean, the work that has been done by the Canadian government in supporting the whole peacekeeping process. In fact, it was the Canadian government that supported a major study that included people from 15 countries across the world to seriously examine this whole issue of the responsibility to protect. And what is it that we can do to prevent war? Like, we can, you know, what can we actually do to respond immediately to crimes against humanity and the threat of genocide, rather than waiting until the genocide is actually exceeding national borders and is reaching catastrophic proportions? And it is that focus on constructive alternatives, which in my own experience, and I invite others to join on this, that I have found really most effective in persuading people who are conservative. Until I moved to Meadville, Lombard, I've been teaching for 16 years at the University of Missouri, and our student body population, 75% identify themselves as conservative, and many of them are in school because they get scholarships, because they're in part of ROTC, they come from military families. And the major reason while they've rejected the peace movement is they don't find us offering any compelling responses of other ways that we can act when there are dire threats. And when there has been a discussion of, say, the role of the International Criminal Court or the use of peacekeeping forces in addition to civilian forces, I find people very interested in exploring. And one last point is, given what even the Pentagon is calling the debacle in Iraq and the ongoing war in Afghanistan, we really have a chance now, I think, to speak to people who 5 years ago wouldn't have been serious about exploring alternatives to war.
Mm-hmm. My name is Michelle Edgar. I'm from New Jersey. And my question is, you know, I have growing concern about a situation occurring in Iran. I've been reading countless articles now about the potential of this happening before this administration leaves. And, you know, you would think with Afghanistan and Iraq, the fact that there's a conversation now about Iran and it hasn't gone away is a great concern to me. In the meantime, Jimmy Carter goes over to the Middle East to talk to Hamas to see if there's some way of trying to discuss peaceful resolutions. And are the United States, and Condoleezza Rice has said that there should be no conversations whatsoever. And you know, that is unacceptable. So I just wanted your thoughts on these issues.
Well, I think we have a very dangerous few months ahead of us, because while many people within the military from the ground up are recognizing the futility of military force as a response to security threats, like those facing Israel, those they posed if Iran had nuclear weapons, unfortunately, many people in the Bush administration seem to be working under that assumption that force is the ultimate type of power. And one of the things I find, again, quite interesting is that it's a Unitarian Universalist, Joseph Nye, who's a political scientist who worked in the Clinton administration and who is a theorist who's talked about, he uses the distinction of hard power and soft power. Now, I don't like the gender connotations, but I like what he's talking about is very interesting, because he said hard power is military and economic coercion, and it can be of limited effect, but in situations, like especially with Iran, his case would be that soft power, which is using diplomatic persuasion, talking to people, cultural influence, for example, the fact that there is such resistance to the kind of hierarchy and authoritarianism of the Iranian government now by young people in Iran, that we have here a source that could be nurtured and supported, a yearning for more democracy and for more freedoms. And we're going to lose that if we, of course, invade, if we resort again to a military force that makes those people within Iran who would be our allies, if we make them then our enemies.
This is Larry Sears,
Cincinnati. I had a question about the apparent difficulty of conceding that force is not the ultimate form of power and alternatives are needed, and yet at the same time embracing the use of force to prevent genocide in Darfur or Rwanda.
And this is where I think we do have a, at one level it's a theoretical paradox, but it's a practical reality that many of us have lived with for decades, hundreds of years. And I think we realize that within countries, for example, the rule of law, as much as we emphasize the importance of waging conflict nonviolently through the political process, we still have police forces. And I think one of the things that we've learned with police forces is that while a modicum of force may be necessary, it has to be carefully monitored and held accountable, because when it isn't, it in itself becomes a disruption of social order rather than a bulwark of social order.
Are there Quakers and Mennonites who nonetheless have not made the paradigm shift and who remain absolute pacifists even against humanitarian intervention where force is used?
Right. And there are Catholics and Buddhists. And what is interesting, though, is I think that within traditional pacifist circles, there are some who are making the shift and are recognizing. And so we find among some of the statements of Thich Nhat Hanh and the Dalai Lama, for example, the needs for international police forces. But again, a focus on being, you know, similar to community policing rather than being like a military force. And there are those, you're right, absolutely others, who retain a principled and even strategic commitment to nonviolence and think that we should be able to eliminate.
As a political scientist, I would use the term peacemaking in a different way than you've presented it. My understanding of the different UN approaches differentiates peacemaking, which entails the use of force to bring a halt to combat, from peacekeeping, which is an intervention between two parties that have accepted a ceasefire and invited a neutral buffer force between them.
Right, and I think in our next next segment of this discussion, we're going to be looking at that in more detail. And because I'm sure, as you know quite well, there are four generations of what we call UN peacekeeping operations, and some that were there that did not use force to protect civilian populations, and were only there with the consent of the parties, moving to the more the kinds of interventions that we have now.
Yeah. If you're referring to the upcoming teleseminar on the 12th of May, that is indeed the one I will be speaking at. So.
Excellent. And I think it would be very important to explore that, as well as the lessons that have been learned in that evolution of UN operations, and I think it's very significant at the UN now, the Peace Building Commission that exists, the exploration,
of course,
the peace services.
The focus, as I phrase it, will be it's on reconciling UU humanitarian hawks and pacifist doves. So I'll yield the floor to others for this session.
Well, everyone, join again. The conversation will be an interesting one. Other questions and comments?
This is Larry Schaefer, and I'm, as usual, fascinated by a concept like conflict resolution as being something that, again, seems to fit at every level. But initially, you seem to entertain it as being part of peacemaking initially, most explicitly tonight. And I actually like that idea, but I think it potentially detracts from the importance of peace building, which I find counter to what the way you've looked at this before. I would like to say that a lot of the sort of energy for this kind of analysis, I think, comes from what originally was called peacemaking, and that's the term that was used in a lot of the original major faith statements. And it had to do and with, you know, European issues and things like that, probably. But the way a lot of Americans at that time became convinced that this was sort of the solution, that we had to be more active in conflict resolution as a part of any potentially or already occurring humanitarian disaster. I still think that there's a lot to be said about good mediation, as you did say, getting United Nations more active in that area as well as in peace building.
Oh yes, for example, quite recently, there weren't standing trained conflict mediators at the UN or as being part of regional security organizations. And I think there's a recognition that there need to be mediators that are culturally sensitive, who can understand when you go into a particular setting, both the kind of histories that are there as well as the way in which conflict is perceived. And John Paul Lederach, I highly recommend his work, because he does describe the art even of working with resistance to peace. And he talks about how efforts to reach a peace accord or create a platform often fail when we don't include those who are opposed and we don't understand their concerns. And I see this circling back around to the very first question about how do we help our work for peace speak to a larger audience. And again, the gift of really listening deeply to people who share more conservative points of view and finding those places where we do have similar aspirations and where there is quite often legitimate critique of the peace movement. And so we can learn from each other and work in ways that I think are really quite compelling and constructive and timely.
And I think that is, as I tried to say, in terms of talking about my motivation in the supporting the original sponsoring of the movement, one way to look at that historically in terms of the kinds of Second Vatican Conference of spinoff in the 60s and so on is that conflict resolution can actually provide in skilled hands, and itself be anti-violence.
Yes.
In an effective public way. And even your youth, who like to think that way about, say, their own personal relationships, somehow have a lot of difficulty in extending that. But I think there are evidences actual concrete successful international ventures that can be tied in with international organizations better, and are, as you say, are in the process perhaps of doing that.
Yes. Yeah, thank you.
Hi, Sharon. John.
Hi, John.
Hi. I feel like I should call you professor. I'm beginning to feel more and more like your student. I learned so much from you. I really appreciate it. This was another one of those instances. One of the things that occurs to me as I hear all this is that as we've worked on this over the past 2.5 years, we have come to the conclusion that that we can look at very similar kinds of relationships at every level of peacemaking, whether it's an internal kind of peacemaking we're making within ourselves, whether it's an interpersonal kind of peace conflict we're looking at, or something within, say, a congregation, or in a culture, or between nations. And do you think that the idea of peacemaking, peace building, and peacekeeping pertains to all those levels of conflict? Are there analogous relationships at, say, interpersonal peacemaking as there are can the same kinds of processes be used?
Well, you know, I think there are. You know, I mean, in some ways, I hadn't teased it out as much. I mean, I think following what Larry was saying and you were pointing out, I think one of the ways where it's easiest to see it is, say, the whole field of conflict resolution and nonviolent communication, and so the process on interpersonal relations or intercongregation, not letting really disparate views turn us into enemies, but really seeking a third way of really building on the insights that everyone has. And it's extremely difficult, you know, quite often to do that when there are deep-seated differences. I think one might look, and this I would have to, you know, it's kind of brainstorming, and I really don't know the answers, but I think it's very intriguing to think of if you look at peace building as being looking at basic forms of structural justice. You know, if people, I think we might look there at issues of education and political access, that if we don't have those kind of democratic institutions within our congregations or within our families, we can't be involved in real nonviolent communication on that kind of interpersonal level either. So there's matters of structural justice that have to be addressed at that level too. It's not, the conflicts quite often can't be resolved just sitting around the table if there are real power imbalances. And so those have to be redressed as well. No, that's a very interesting point.
And I'm thinking, of course, on how we're going to finally present, you know, this to the GA and to the congregations. And, you know, one thing that I'm convinced of that I'm going to really try to work hard for in the future is that we don't ask binary questions in study action issues. Because I don't think that anything worthwhile has a yes or no answer. And the whole idea of transcending this, the kind of one thing that came to mind in all this, and it's been really kind of on my mind a lot lately, is that I think we have an extremely significant opportunity to bring in military people into this effort. And I wonder if you had any ideas on how we... it seems to me that this idea of not having not going into this with a hard and fast position on this, but looking at justice and peace, would be attractive to to returning veterans or to people in the military, that particularly Unitarian Universalists in the military.
Well, I happen to know this in this last quarter at Meadville, I taught a course on strategic peace building, and two members of the course have both been on active duty in Iraq and will be returning and are studying to be military chaplains. And they're very interested. They want to be part of this conversation, and there is a group that has been formed of military voices. And I know I'm working with one of these students. He's working very much now on clarifying his questions and thoughts, and welcomes the invitation that the core group has made, that for this to be a real conversation, we do need to hear more from the military voices of people who are Unitarian Universalists.
Yep.
And when I talk to him, I find many of my assumptions being challenged in ways that I couldn't begin to speak for people in the military, but I really want us to think
with them. I'm finding the same thing. We have some assumptions that may not be right about military.
Exactly.
Yep.
You know, this is Michelle Edgar again. We had an experience in our area recently where we have a vigil on the third Saturday of every month in front of a recruiting station. Mm-hmm. And this particular month, two gentlemen decided to join us. And one was a World War II vet. The other gentleman was a Vietnam veteran. And the young men that work at the recruiting station came out. And initially, one of the men was very, that he was. They were all invited to participate and sing with us, and he took the music sheet and ripped it up and was very angry. But then a conversation ensued between the veterans from World War II and from Vietnam and these young men. Mm. And when the young men realized that they were talking to, fellow soldiers.
Right.
There was like this relationship. They were actually very honored to have this conversation with these men. And what was surprising was that a lot of these young men that are right now part of the service, they are unaware of the issues. They actually really don't understand like what we're all talking about in the conversations and the issues that revolve around it. Around these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, they really have no idea. They're so immersed in this culture and just what their duty is and what they're supposed to do. They really don't know what, they're not listening to what the arguments and issues are. So it was very interesting because they seemed to be surprised when they were hearing all these points made by these two gentlemen. Typically, it's usually just like a group of women that get together and sing on this vigil. And so there's almost no communication at all. But on this particular day, because there were two gentlemen there, the conversation opened up. And then it was just amazing that, soldiers and veterans talking together, it seemed to have an impact.
One of the things that I've picked up that's been interesting, and this is primarily more from people who are officers, all right, so who have had time to think about, who are more, schooled in just war theory and, warfighting doctrine. And there really is, among that segment of many people in the military, a real interest in finding alternatives to war. An example, I was at an International Women's Peace Conference in Dallas last summer, and I attended a panel where there was an officer from the Army and one from the Air Force. And the woman who was from the Army had resigned in protest when the invasion of Iraq took place because she thought it was immoral and foolish and unethical and illegal. And then the woman who was an officer in the Air Force thought the invasion was justified. But they both agreed that in far more, like 100 times more, needs to be done to prevent war rather than waging war, and really wanting to see genuinely one of the tenets of just war theory as a last resort and as proportional. And even though their careers had been with the military, they had found that they were utilized far too often to resolve what were political and economic and cultural problems.
So that's Judy,
Michelle.
We're at the end of our time for the formal seminar, and everyone is welcome to stay on the line and chat further, but we're going to close the formal portion. I want to mention that if any of our listeners would like to become involved in the Peacemaking Study Action Issue program, either at the congregational or national level, please check the website at uua.org/peacemaking for the latest opportunities for involvement. I want to thank Sharon for a fascinating seminar, and thank you for being here. And we're going to end the formal seminar now. Mac?